The Miller Center and the University of Virginia are pleased to welcome all of you and our special guest, Chase Untermyer. We were worried that the balmy weather would limit your attendance. Little did we know that a thunderstorm would supplant the balmy weather. Chase Untermyer, as most of you know, is director of the Presidential Personnel Office, involved in the choice and management of the transition process, and before that was chief of the chief transition planner during the Bush campaign. Mr. Untermyer was born in Long Branch, New Jersey. He is a graduate of Harvard, not Yale. He was a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. He was a member of the Texas House of Representatives from 1977 to 1981. He served in the Reagan administration as executive assistant to the vice president from 1981 to 1983 and assistant secretary of the Navy from 1984 until the end of that administration. He was a fellow at the Institute of Politics, served to lieutenant in the United States Navy, is the author of Houston Survival Handbook. It's been the special privilege of the Miller Center to meet with him in August as he was planning the transition, and now to have this happy reunion with a number of scholars and writers who have spent most of the day with him. We thought many of you would want, as we have, the special opportunity, unique opportunity, to have a discussion with Mr. Untermyer.
Thank you, Ken, and members of the university community. I welcome this chance to be in this historic and beautiful place, not only for its own sake, but because this gave me an excuse to get away from my office. In fact, last night, staying overnight here in Charlottesville, was the first night spent away from Washington, D.C. since December 3rd, which underscores just how involving the business of personnel in a new administration can be. I also welcome this as a chance to get away from many of those clients, petitioners, coattail pullers, whatever you would like to call them, who influence my current life. But it isn't just my life. One of my predecessors in this job, a fellow named Pendleton James, who had that role during the early Reagan administration, told me a story from those days which illustrates the special difficulty of anyone who holds this job. The story is that one day, Penn came back from a meeting to find the curator of the White House, Clement Conger, standing expectantly at his door. And Clem greeted Penn James and said, "Miss James, you'll be happy to know that one of the privileges that you have as a member of the president's staff is to be able to put on your wall various artwork of the White House collection. Is there anything we could do for you?" And Penn said, "Well, that's very thoughtful of you. You know, my favorite character in American history is Benjamin Franklin. By any chance, do you have a picture of him?" And Clem Conger said, "Absolutely, I have one that I think you'll like. Anything else?" And Penn said, "Oh, if I get to choose another, my wife's favorite president is Thomas Jefferson. Might you have anything of him?" "Indeed we do, and I bring one that I think you'll also like." Days pass. Penn came back from yet another meeting to find Clem Conger standing at his door even more expectantly. And he knew, as a matter of guess, that the pictures were on the wall, as indeed they were. He walked into the office, and there, as promised, on the left was a picture of Benjamin Franklin, and there on the right was a picture of Mr. Jefferson, and there in the middle was a portrait of a heavily bearded gentleman in a frock coat whom Ken James couldn't identify at all. And he said, "Who is that?" Which, of course, gave the curator exactly the opening he was hoping for. He said, with great delight, he said, "That is President Garfield, shot by a disappointed office seeker." the dangers are still there, and in my present life, there are all kinds of adventures to relate. One that occurred just last week illustrates this, that shows the nature of human beings in the business of personnel. There are enough people like disappointed office seekers who take pot shots at you for not giving them something good, but it actually works with people to whom you do give something good, if you will, the degree of ingratitude that comes from that. There was a case of an individual, name to be withheld, who matters a great deal to the president and didn't want a full-time job. So we looked through our book of part-time boards and commissions, and one of the very best, name also to be withheld, is a particular board that once a year takes its members on a special trip to Europe. Now, this definitely is one of the best plums that can be given in the federal government. And with great triumph, we announced to this individual what wonderful thing we had done for him by putting his name down on the list for this board. The reaction was, he looked at it and he says, it goes to Europe once a year? He says, do you have anything that goes more often to Europe? And I was a bit astonished at that question. I said, yes, TWA. So we can't please everybody in this business, and that may be part of the circumstance of the part of what Mr. Jefferson well knew of human nature in a governmental context. And I don't doubt for a moment that while the nature of this federal government has changed since his time and the nature of the jobs have changed, that the dynamic is still there of too many people chasing too few jobs and being unhappy about the result, whatever the result may be. My encounter with this is born in what we're truly gathered to discuss, which is less personnel than it is the presidential transition process. It was on an afternoon in late December 1987 at the Christmas party, as a matter of fact, of the then vice president, that I suggested that what he would need as a presidential candidate would be a very quiet effort to begin to plan the possibility of his winning the presidency and taking the reins of the government after November 1988. Well, as was the case, the vice president listened with great interest and a few days later called me up to pursue the point, such that I was invited back to that house, the vice president's house, on a very snowy evening in early January to discuss it further. The outlines were born that evening, were developed as time passed and as he secured the Republican nomination after Super Tuesday. The outlines of that project were going to be that I would operate by myself on a consultant basis paid for by the Republican National Committee so that there would be no question of use of campaign funds or privately raised funds for that purpose, and that my operation would be specifically independent from the campaign and from his Office of the Vice President government staff. Those decisions were very important to what was done in the Bush transition planning. There were, and with specific reasons why. Number one is that because the focus of this effort was geared toward an election and toward a government that had not yet been formed by vote of the American people, it was improper for me to be on the vice president's staff again. And also, it would be wrong for me to be on the campaign staff. For a number of reasons why. One is that the Federal Election Commission had ruled that campaign funds could not be used for transition planning. Curious decision of the commission, but still the law. And the second reason was the basic political reason, which was that if transition planning was conducted in close proximity to the campaign, that I would prove to be too strong a magnet, that all those people who should have been paying attention to winning the election for George Bush would have somehow been finding a way to drop by my office, coffee cup in hand, to sort of linger and drop a resume or talk about their wonderful deeds or otherwise try to get their name and face fixed in my mind like a photograph, such that after Election Day, I would remember them and remember them favorably. The whole idea of this effort was to be a quiet, even academic project in which I came to this university to speak to the people at the Miller Center, to talk to other veterans of transitions and observers on the political scene, to formulate recommendations to the candidate to be adopted as the transition plan if he were elected. The aim, as I mentioned, was to do this as quietly as possible. My cover, however, was blown when, in an article, an interview that the candidate gave to David Broder of the Washington Post in mid-late July of last year, he mentioned my name as in charge of a transition planning project way down in the article. Well, it may have been buried in that part of the article, but it was enough to cause my telephones to start ringing, the mailbags to start flooding in with all sorts of unsolicited offers of help in the event of George Bush's election. That was, of course, what we tried to avoid, but there was a great advantage in that my being a lightning rod for those efforts did free up the campaign organization to do its main job, to do what he asked it to do, which was to win the election for him. so that my operation was not seen as either a rival pole for talent and attention, and neither was I seen as a rival in preference to anybody who was working in those particular ventures. So lessons learned of the past, because in 1976, President Carter, or Governor Carter as he then was, set up a transition planning operation which was too close in proximity to the Carter campaign, so that jealousies grew and festered, and that one of the things that occurred out of that was to alienate the decision-making on personnel, for example, from the leaders of the campaign. After the election of President Carter, Hamilton Jordan, his campaign manager, basically dismissed the transition planning operation and took it unto himself, such that a great deal of the work that was done in the transition plan was lost. I suspect, although I don't know for a fact, that that experience is what led to Governor Dukakis to make sure that his transition planning operation was very closely knit to his campaign organization, to be in the headquarters building or close to it, unlike the decision that President Bush made, which was to keep me physically separate and organizationally separate. The planning that was done was with an aim toward the process only. What way would policy be determined if George Bush were elected president? What way would personnel be selected in that event? It was not to be policy formulation, and it was not to be personnel selection. These days, when there is a question, I think an invalid one, as to the pace of appointments in this administration, people ask, how could it be, or why couldn't you have moved faster? Why couldn't you have used the time better between the election and the inauguration in terms of personnel selection? And the answer goes back to that very smart political call which then Vice President Bush made, which was not to have any such distraction during the campaign, not to have it known that there was somebody, myself or someone else, dealing in matters of collecting resumes, interviewing people, choosing staffs, otherwise acting as if an election had been won and the government was in formation. No doubt that would have cut a lot of time off of what eventually occurred after the election. But that was a very foolhardy thing to have done politically, and it certainly would have set the wrong tone that he was trying to set. So what we did produce out of the transition planning operation of 1988 was, I think, a very good and valid plan, one that led to the proper structuring of what was a 73-day government agency called the Office of the President-Elect. I should say that as a result of congressional action, there has been for approximately 20 years, 25 years, funding for whoever wins the presidency. There was an effort in 1988 for the first time to do pre-election funding for those sorts of plans. The money was not appropriated. That did not go through in this particular phase, but I think could well crop up again in the next election cycle. As a matter of practical effect, the additional money that was proposed for pre-election transition planning was not necessary, at least in the case of the Dukakis and Bush campaigns, because we found alternate sources. In the case of the Dukakis campaign, they set up a separate foundation that raised money precisely for the purpose of pre-election transition planning. In the case of the Republicans, I was attached to the Republican National Committee. And I would say in the future, that's probably the better thing for parties to do, which is to let their ongoing party organizations during a campaign year be the umbrella or the home of any transition planning. At least that gets the transition planning operation away from the often messy business of fundraising. It would not have been a problem to raise money. The problem would have been exactly the opposite, the ease of raising money for a transition, in which many people would have flooded forward with contributions, hoping that I or the campaign manager or whoever else might be very grateful to them for bringing money across the line for that purpose. Money was needed for other purposes during a campaign, as you well know, and that's the reason why the operation was well done. I think the transition operation of 1988-89 was a success in that it did establish what the procedures and policies would be. The policies are seen in the speech the President gave to the Congress on February 9th, in which he laid out what he called Building a Better America, his program for such things as diverse as strategic defense to education and child care, and also in the business of planning the personnel selection process. Again, I was under strict orders not to do any recruiting, not to give anybody even a wink that they were going to be chosen for any job, including my own staff, before the election, and I carried that out. The result is that we had to do that during the transition itself. Had a great head start in doing it, in that I had many conversations before the election with the fellow who had the job that I now hold, a man named Bob Tuttle, and he and his staff proved to be exceedingly helpful to me and to others in the business of knowing how the job is done. Had we not had the so-called friendly transition of one party following itself in power, that sort of cooperative relationship would not have occurred and might have even been very hostile. In fact, I think it can be said that had Governor Dukakis won the election, that Bob Tuttle and company were prepared to be very cool on any requests for cooperation, that would have been, in essence, a more traditional transition of difficult handovers rather than a friendly one. One of the firm conclusions of the transition planning operation, which I gave to the presidential candidate of the day, was that we should take advantage of the fact that this was going to be a friendly transition, the first time in 60 years that a president of one party would succeed a president of his own party. That being a decision, we would be able to take advantage of Reagan policies, Reagan appointees, if you will, a continuation of the administration of which George Bush was a prime player. And without any surprise to the voters of America, was exactly what would have happened if George Bush had been elected. No one was the least bit surprised, nor should they have been deceived, that a victory of George Bush would be for a continuation of those policies with a gradual and appropriate shading into the distinctiveness that will be a Bush administration. During 5.5 sessions, I debriefed the president and the vice president, his campaign manager, and the governor of New Hampshire, who today are the president, the secretary of state, and the chief of staff to the president, on what my findings were. This allowed us to get decisions, to get directions in stages and bites during the pre-election phase, such that it was not necessary after an election, a time of peak exhaustion, peak desire and demand on the part of a winning candidate to get off to the rocky coast of Maine and to forget about such things until a later date. All those decisions had been made, the basic direction set as of the election, which made it possible for us to stride forward and to set up that office of the president-elect. Let me depart from history to give you some of the conclusions and looking ahead a bit as to the way I think transitions will go in the future based on the 1988 experience. First of all, it seems to me that one very obvious fact comes out about transitions, so obvious that it may even invite a chuckle, but it seems to me the more I think about it, the key to all of it in terms of proper planning. And that is that a transition can never occur often enough for any one individual or group of individuals to have any practice at it. It will almost always or inevitably be done by people who are doing it for the first time. It seems obvious that if one party is in office and is elected in a given year and they have the experience of a transition, and if that party loses at the polls 4 years later, then it's the other party that has the experience of transition. And if it turns out that Party A gets returned to office 8 years later, that the minimum amount of time for the original transition planners to come back and do it again is that 8 years. It might even be longer, as would be the case when the time comes for the Democrats to come back into the White House. And there's no guarantee in that 8-year period that the same players are going to be doing the transition planning. As friendly as the relationship was between the Reagan and Bush forces, there was never any obligation, never any inclination on the part of the Bush campaign to go take the Reagan transition crew from 1980-81 and put them in charge of the transition planning for George Bush. We certainly conferred quite a lot with those individuals, but there was only one instance I know in which the 80-81 transition planners just assumed as a matter of practice that they would be involved in the cycle that involved George Bush. And I might add, their assumption was presumption and led to a rather unfriendly set of clashes. But I'm happy to say that that was brief. It didn't affect the planning of the transition. It didn't affect the election. What it influenced had nothing to do with personnel, nothing to do with policy, but rather with the administrative side of transition planning, getting the office equipment and finding out how best to use IBM equipment or dealing with matters of security at the door. That was the only area in which there was any such collision. And it was brief, it was over. But to say again, there's no guarantee that people from one transition are going to be the principals in the next transition. There's certainly no guarantee that whenever it may be in the next Republican transition, that Untermeyer, wherever he is, in a retirement home in Florida, or whenever it is going to be called back and put in charge of that transition. Somebody else will be in charge of that, and that individual will be doing it also for the first time. So the nature of the business is that you can never quite get the hang of it before you have to do it, and you never get the hang of it while you're doing it before it's over. It also seems to me that one aspect of the transition of 1988-89 is the question of just what the results were. You can see a lot of print and in certain restaurants in Washington at lunchtime you could hear a lot of talk of criticism that the transition of the new administration of George Bush is too slow. That is very much not just an inside the Beltway commentary. I think it's only inside a few of those restaurants and a few other buildings of note inside the city of Washington, because I cannot deny, no one could deny, that the lack of an appointee at the assistant secretarial rank here or there might be impairing to some degree a particular government agency and possibly affecting a program or two that agency may carry out. But I think only a very few specialized players would contend that the lack of that individual is crucial to the government, not to have that particular individual. Because after all, what matters at the start of an individual, of an administration, are not the number of appointees in place, but rather the formulation of that administration's policies, the leadership shown by the president, the direction the administration takes. And from the beginning of this administration, all those key players have been in place to begin with. Those key players being, of course, the president and vice president, their principal staffs, the cabinet officers who were named under the normal schedule of things, and their principal staffs. That's all you need in formulating an administration. The fact that an assistant secretary or two elsewhere in those cabinet departments might not be named is not a matter of policy formulation. Where it matters, and where, of course, we will have those people well in place before it is necessary, is in policy execution. After such time as the policies have been adopted or enacted by the Congress and funded through the same process. In the meantime, no one could contend that the lack of an appointee here or there has in any way kept the Bush administration from making some significant achievements in formulating its budget to meet the president's commitment to having a flexible freeze as well as no new taxes, getting an agreement with the principals in the Congress on that budget, and getting an agreement to end one of the most contentious, divisive issues of the 1980s, which was on what to do in Central American policy, in coming with a solution to one of the most grievous threats to American economic fiber, namely the condition of the savings and loans institutions, coming up with an agreement or a decision on the mix of missiles between the MX and Midget Man missile systems that had been evading any solution for many years because of the difficulty of that seemingly insoluble problem, for coming up with a decision on the sale of the FSX and its components to Japan, and coming up with plans on childcare, education, and the other components that the president had campaigned on. I'm leaving out two or three other issues, but these are sufficient, I think, to make the point that in the opinion of some that this administration has gotten off to a, quote, slow start is belied by the results. And certainly the American people don't have that notion because President Bush is in the polls some 10 or 20 points higher than where he ended at the polls in November 1988. And by some results of those polls, he's even up to historically high levels in the range of 71%. Now, if it were so that this administration were crippled, that it was directionless or rudderless and otherwise not doing its job, that result just wouldn't be there. The American people are clearly satisfied with what the administration is doing because they're getting what they voted for in November, which is continuity of the policies of the Reagan-Bush administration with the additional benefits, I'd like to think, of building on top of them in terms of what George Bush personally brings to that office. All these things within the first 100 days of an administration does indicate an administration and a president who are in control and know what they want to do. The reason for this, I might add, is simple. And the simple aspect, as I mentioned, is that the key players are very much in place and would be in place anyway as a campaign ends and a president continues with those particular people that he had working for him in the campaign, such as a Jim Baker, or such as Governor Sununu, or such as many other people whose names would be less familiar to you who worked in the back shops of the campaign offices on those particular issues that were in September and October speech material that today are actual presentation of or actual proposals pending before the Congress. A final word on the man who is president that provides the real reason behind all of this. And you can discount what I'm about to say because of the pleasure I've had of being associated with him going back to my student days when I was, first of all, a campaign worker in his first race for Congress in Houston, and then an intern on his staff when he was a freshman congressman. And that is that George Bush does bring to this office the full benefit of what serving 8 years as a vice president and 10 years in public office before that and a variety of assignments would be expected to bring. If anything, and I am not trying to inflate matters because I think his record speaks for himself, he is very much a president in the tradition of the presidents who were we were lucky to have at the start of our country's history, presidents of the sort who knew this town and knew this campus. That is, people like Jefferson or Madison or Monroe or an Adams were experienced government officials, had served as ambassadors, had served in other ministries before becoming president, and could bring to the job of president the full understanding of how the system works, as well as an understanding of the people who are in politics and how they respond accordingly. That's a very refreshing and, I think, reassuring aspect of what President Bush has in his government. It's reflected, I believe, in the quality of the individuals. And if it takes a little bit longer, in the opinion of some folks, for us to select those individuals, I'm unapologetic over that, because any large corporation, and we're dealing with here the biggest corporation of all, the federal government, would not hesitate a moment to take whatever time is needed to find the sorts of executives needed to run multi-billion dollar operations affecting the lives and fortunes of so many people. So that degree of comfort with taking the time to get the quality of individuals is what the president has continued to signal to me as we've gone forward in this process. I'm perfectly willing to have a bad news story now or then in February, March, or April of this year about the supposed slow pace of putting the government together if I can be at the same time spared stories 6 and 18 months from now about some grievous behavior or scandalous acts done by one of those appointees who might have been chosen quickly but not well at all. And that will be the end result of this. It will be, if you will, the dog that does not bark that determines the last note of the transition planning process. That is, an administration which functions without attention because the people who are in those jobs are doing their jobs and doing them well. I might add, one dog that isn't barking, and I take this occasion, even though it doesn't relate directly to transition, to point it out, is the absence of any stories you might have seen or heard on television about dissension and turmoil within the White House staff. We're practically used to the fact that in the first year of an administration, be it a Reagan or a Carter or a Ford or Nixon, there would be stories of factions on the White House staff. People ranged against each other. Leaks to the newspaper about what stupidity was being conducted by the individual at a meeting the Thursday before and what terrible things were going to result if that guy's policies got put into effect. You have not heard or seen any of that. The only thing that even comes close to it was a day's ruffle in which the White House counsel said, in carrying out the president's requirements on appearance of impropriety, that even as important and as a close a friend as the Secretary of State, Jim Baker, was, that he would have to divest himself of certain bank stock in order to meet the standards that the president had set. There was a flurry about that because it made it seem like this was some kind of clash, but the fact is that Mr. Baker did sell that stock because he also knew what the president's rules were with regard to the appearance of impropriety, not that anybody accused him of such an impropriety. With the exception of that one daily flutter, There's been a total absence of any such stories about intrigue and Machiavellian activities in the White House staff. And there's a very simple reason for that, and that is that the people that this president has chosen to be in his staff and to carry out those policies come out of the same background, if you will, as he. That is, I don't mean that in any kind of educational or social sense, but rather a background that says that what matters is public service. What matters is plain dealing and straight dealing. What matters are the essential issues that propel American life, such as family, military service, and hard work in the private sector. Those kind of people are the ones who have been put in the White House staff. They, many of them, have come out of Bush campaigns going back to Texas days or the late 70s. They are of a part of a piece, if you will, with the president. And that is what has made for a much closer relationship among the White House staffers. I look around the table every morning and I see people who are there whom I've known for many years, who are personal friends of mine, people who in 5 or 4 years ago I would have called up and asked to get together for lunch or get together for some other social gathering because they were friends, not knowing that in 1989 we would be colleagues on the White House staff. Because of that circumstance, the leadership at the White House level has been without such dissension and without such difficulty, and the Chief of Staff, Governor Sununu, reminds us that we are working for a man who has great trust in us and expects us to do our best because that's what he expects of himself. So that in that context, the results, I'd say, are ones of greater degrees of cooperation, but best of all, greater degrees of quietness in terms of attention paid to the West Wing of the White House than is typically the case. Well, I thank you for your attention to these semi-formed ramblings here. And in whatever time is left to me, I'll be very delighted to take any questions on this or any related theme. Yes, sir.
What's the role of the district law firms, if any, in selection or recruitment for possible appointments?
Let's see, did everybody hear the question? Should I repeat it? It was that what role was played by law firms within the District of Columbia in the solutions, in the recruitment and selection process? I'd say very little if what you mean by saying law firms, meaning those various law firms that are skilled at influencing government decisions rather than handling cases of one kind or another. In fact, it was a specific determination on the part of George Bush that the K Street lobbying law firms would not have such influence as they had had in the past. He made several decisions even during the campaign, which indicated that as much as he knew these individuals and as much as many of them were considered almost family gods in the Republican household, that they would not necessarily have a role in his administration. This was not antipathetical to these people personally, and I'm speaking of people like Bill Timmons and Tom Korologos, et cetera. But rather a breaking away from the notion that one automatically turned to those sorts of people for doing things, for getting somebody confirmed, for getting somebody in office, for fixing a problem or two. That comes, if you will, from the self-confidence of a president who's been around town a while and knows the game himself and hopefully has got people working for him who also know the game. And it isn't necessary, therefore, to go to the old war horses in order to get certain things done. Now, it may well be that there are some of these lobbying firms who are very much active in behalf of particular candidates for office. If so, they're exceedingly stealthy, because I am personally not aware of any effort being pursued by one of the individuals I mentioned or other people in their line of work in behalf of a particular individual. If they're doing it at all, it's well hidden and is not showing any particular result. Not that it would harm the candidacy of somebody with whom they were identified, but rather the game is quite different, and it isn't quite so necessary. I'm aware of only one case in which one of the Republican worthies on K Street was even involved in one confirmation this year, whereas normally these individuals would be the ones you'd always see sitting next to a controversial cabinet officer at a time of great distress. All it means is we're starting, if you will, a new generation of people, and I like to think that coming out of the Reagan and Bush administrations will be people who will be sitting at those tables in some future decade with some future appointees, and will have the benefit of experience in this administration. Sir.
Tolerate one non-transition question. Refer back to your time in the Navy in your article last year on the proper civil military mix in an agency.
A reader, thank you.
Do you have any longer term plans to look at the mix of Schedule Z versus SES type executives versus military executives in certain situations like the presumed procurement professionalization of that workforce?
The question was if we'd thought about the mix between political appointees and career individuals in particular in military procurement, but of course the answer does go broader than that. We're right now in the process of coming up with the top line that is presidential appointees at the Department of Defense. That was delayed, of course, by the amount of time taken in the confirmation battle over Senator Tower, and the amount of time that has gone on since the selection of Secretary Cheney has been a good example of the sub-cabinet selection process in which the lead is given to the cabinet department to come up with names, many of them supplied by my office, but gotten from other sources as well, and for us to get together to look over the qualifications of those individuals. Tomorrow afternoon, I will have yet another meeting in the series with the individual whom Secretary Cheney has chosen to be doing his personnel work. And in fact, tomorrow's session, we're due to address the acquisition side of the appointments to be made in the Pentagon. I'd say that you can expect to see a continuation of the sorts of people who have been named to those sorts of jobs in the past, by which I mean people who come out of a background of either military service or experience on the procurement business themselves, plus a mixture of career individuals who are skilled in the rules and regulations of procurement. These days, those rules and regulations are such that people, that proves to be a restriction upon those whom you can recruit because they may be deemed to be biased in some way, having been in the procurement process. So, in effect, you have to start out with those who are not presumed to be in favor of any particular corporation. One of the hidden, stories to come out of the Tower confirmation, not so much a story, but a warning flag, is that if John Tower was considered unacceptable as Secretary of Defense because he had been a consultant for a defense contractor, what does that say in the future about choosing an outright defense contractor to be an appointee? I don't think that there should be necessarily a bar for having a person who comes out of the procurement world in an appointed position, so long as it's obvious that that individual divests himself or herself of any holdings and recuses himself or herself from any decisions in which their former company might have been involved. Another solution to that is to use more people from the career force who have not been sullied by higher incomes that they could have gotten by being in the private sector. And many people of that experience were named to positions in the Reagan administration, a good example being my former colleague Everett Pyatt, who is still today the Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Shipbuilding and Logistics, a career federal employee who was recognized as having knowledge of the system that was better than anything that could be gotten in the private sector. It's going to be much harder in the future to get anybody to those sorts of jobs because we're moving in the direction of severely limiting what a person can do after he or she leaves government service. It may well be that that individual, as skilled as they may be in matters of procurement, will be forbidden to be in any form of procurement, selling into the federal government and matters of defense for at least a period of time, and perhaps, as some proposals have it, forever. And when that happens, I'm not quite sure where we're going to get people or where those people we do get are expected to earn a living afterwards. So that in between is going to be one of the more difficult businesses of personnel selection. I might add it's something that doesn't affect in the same degree people who go to work for any other department as it does in DOD. Yep.
How did you go about the very delicate task of easing out all the loyal Republicans that had been appointed by Ronald Reagan, and how much personnel turnover did you expect, and how much are you probably going to end up with?
The question was, how did we ease out the appointees of President Reagan, and with what result in terms of numbers? I'd say that of all the challenges that have come through this process, including the battering that I may personally have taken in the press from time to time, the most wrenching of all has been the discharging, the saying goodbye to the appointees of President Reagan, not at the presidentially appointed ranks, that is, assistant secretaries and cabinet secretaries, but rather at the Schedule C levels, that is, those who are the foot soldiers of politics who get jobs as secretaries or special assistants or general purpose aides. Those people were all co-religionists of a sense in that they were part of the Reagan-Bush administration, and many of them were personal friends of a lot of us, including myself. And yet, there was no question that we were bringing in the front door a number of people who had worked in the George Bush Dan Quayle campaign. And under the rules of the game, they were referred to the cabinet departments for consideration for these jobs. I use that phrase because it's legally correct. That is, the White House cannot order cabinet departments to hire anybody off the campaign. It's against the law, as a matter of fact. But we can certainly give them lists of people and say that here are individuals who worked loyally and hard for the election of the president and vice president, and we encourage you or urge you to consider them for appointment to Schedule C, that is, non-career jobs in the federal government. You were giving those lists of names to the cabinet departments, that is, so that people could come in the front door, and because there were already incumbents in those jobs, somebody had to go out the back door. And they were, of course, the Schedule C appointees of President Reagan's government. That exceedingly wrenching. Some of them, as I mentioned, were personal friends of mine, and yet I could not, should not have intervened to preserve a personal friend of mine here or there, because that would have been outright favoritism, would have become instantly known, and I would have been justifiably condemned. So that it was personally painful, not just for me, but for others in my staff who were getting similar appeals. I should say that the sole regret I have of the transition period, now speaking of the post-inaugural period, is that I and my colleague, who's the cabinet secretary, did not issue very strict guidance to the departments on how to deal with the departure of those appointees. We took it for granted that in the kindlier, gentler notion of a Bush administration, that those departments would proceed with letting people go in whatever thoughtful and considerate manner might be the case. And some did that. Some even put together special programs for those appointees on and what's called in the personnel business outplacement, talking to recruiters on how to write resumes and how to use your job skills to best advantage. Unfortunately, several of the departments just sent out pink slips and said that you are to be gone as of a certain date. And I regret especially that some of them said, when challenged on this, oh, we're doing this because the White House made us. The same White House that could not tell people to tell a department to hire somebody also could not tell them to fire somebody. So that mistruth, which probably was meant to save people from being pilloried inside their own departments, has the effect of making a lot of people certain that it's the likes of me and my cohorts who are responsible for their being unemployed. What I wish I could do now differently is to put out very specific guidance to those departments and to say, when time comes that you must, the time to let go of people is only when you have somebody new coming in the door to replace them, because it makes no sense to cashier someone and have an empty desk. And when that time comes that you must say goodbye to that appointee, please call them in, talk to them, explain the situation, say that this is necessary because new people are coming, that it isn't the dirty old White House which is forcing you to make this happen. And to the extent you can, try to help these people adjust either to private life or to tell them how to get in line to get another political appointment elsewhere. There are certain departments, which I will withhold the name of, that did not do this, and I frankly am very disappointed with them. Again, it was my presumption that they would have automatically known how to do things the right way, just because none of the cabinet officers are bad people. They are not Machiavellian, revengeful, vindictive sorts of people. But somehow or another, in certain departments, that job wasn't done very well. And if I could do one thing differently, it would be to put out that guidance. They might not have followed it even then, but I would feel a lot better about the way it was done. Let's see. Yes, sir. The president is committed to having women and minorities in his administration. And in the Republican way of things, we believe in affirmative action in what I call its positive sense, that is, positive affirmative action, meaning the president has made it very clear to me and to members of his cabinet, the chief of staff, that he wants women and minorities in those positions. But we do not believe in what I call negative affirmative action, which is to set up strict quotas or guidelines that restrict the process to the point that a woman or minority member is thought of as a mere number, something to be gotten, as opposed to a person desired because of the qualities that he or she might bring to that job. And it's in that vein that my staff and I, with the good help of Governor Sununu, has been working with cabinet secretaries on that very point. We don't believe in quotas, but we do believe that the whole is the sum of its parts, that there won't be women and minorities in the Bush administration in the aggregate if there are not women and minorities in each department as we proceed. So that in the process of dealing with the cabinet officers on the sub-cabinet appointees, either the presidential appointees at the assistant secretary level or their own appointees at the deputy assistant secretary level, they be reminded constantly of what that policy is. Frankly, that's been done in more successful cases than others, but it's not going to end when the finishing of the first round occurs. That is, if a cabinet department ends up with all of its appointees in place and there may not be women and or minorities in their numbers, we and presidential personnel are not going to blow the whistle or not going to call the game over at that point, because inevitably people do resign or retire, die in office, or they get appointed to other positions and there are openings. And when that happens, our office is going to be able to concentrate much more actively on not only recruiting, locating women and minorities for those positions, but also of making it clear to that cabinet officer that they could do very well to look in directions they didn't look before. Again, not establishing quotas, but letting the results speak for themselves in terms of the presence of people from the rich, the full fabric of American life. And that includes not just women and blacks and browns, but also Asian Americans, disabled Americans, American Indians, and others who, for the most part, have not been as represented in Republican administrations as they should be. Let's see. Yes. Oh. The departments is at heart the concern. I can call cabinet secretaries, but what really matters is that my associates in my office are in touch with their counterparts in those departments who are on the staffs of those secretaries dealing in matters of personnel. In each department, on the staff of the secretary, there's an individual called the White House liaison. That individual works for the cabinet secretary every day, has to go face the boss, draws his or her salary from that department. So they don't work for me. But to the extent that our office has good relations with those individuals, and to the extent that they are on the same program as the White House, can things occur to get that sense of cooperation? There's pretty close parallel between those departments where we have that good relationship and those departments that have been kindlier and gentler in their dealing with personnel issues, and a close parallel on the other side where there has been resistance and the results show it. So a newsletter that is something printed isn't as useful as would be that telephone contact. And clearly, at the appropriate time, and we're pretty much at that time, when the volume of appointments to be made and boxes to be filled goes down, that that's when my staff and I plan to be much more active personally in going to the departments and agencies ourselves to visit with such people as the cabinet secretaries and the White House liaison, to go visit with the selectees, the people who are in office, to begin the next phase, which is to take account of our handiwork, to see how it can be improved, to see who's succeeding, and try to reward that individual by promoting him or her in later rounds, and seeing who's not succeeding, and then come to a conclusion with the cabinet secretary as how best to help ease that individual out of office if it's that bad that what's needed is removal as opposed to better education and motivation of that individual. The business of making presidential appointments never stops, because there are constant vacancies and there are hundreds of non-full-time jobs that need to be filled as well. But I'd like to think that in that calmer period between the different rounds, that we can take better stock of the people who are there now and to think about how constantly to do the job better when we don't have 100% of the jobs to fill, as has been the case in a new administration. Sir.
I did some research on the Kennedy and it struck me at the time that the main emphasis of that was not so much on personnel, although that was very important, but was actually on policy formulation. Now, everything you've said today is about the moving of individuals around or getting people into new jobs in government, and nothing about policy. Is that simply a function of the fact that one Republican administration is succeeding another? Is not so concerned with reassessing its policy views, or is it a function of the fact that the Bush administration is doing that now after the inauguration rather than during the actual transition period?
Well, if I didn't speak about policy, it's entirely because of my blinded view on personnel. During the transition, meaning the post-election period and post-inaugural periods, there were very active efforts in policy formulation parallel to what I was doing on the personnel side. It was not easy, and I'm not diminishing by any means what they accomplished, but frankly their task was a little bit easier than mine because it led to the formulation of concrete proposals, actual legislative initiatives, the writing of position papers, and the publication of a book called Building a Better America, which was released at the time of the President's speech to the Congress on the 9th of February, in which he laid out the larger of these efforts. The policy planning began during the campaign and to a large extent began in the Reagan administration, as you well pointed out, in that the fabric of policies were pretty well known and laid out. To the extent that George Bush's policies differed from those of Ronald Reagan, it was more a matter of emphasis than of total reconstruction. Such things as his emphasis on child care, his emphasis on education, his emphasis on a different attitude toward such things as the budgeting process and on the economy as a whole were discussed during the campaign, were clearly available for people who paid attention to such things, and that process was continued largely by the same people in the transition itself. During the pre-election phase, when I was doing that footwork I mentioned, a large part of my time was spent on personnel, but it was also spent thinking of the way that the policy formulation process would begin, such that that did begin quite rapidly after the election. People went to work knowing that right after the inauguration, President Bush would make an address to Congress and would lay out a program. And they spent their time very well during the transition period itself working on those proposals, such that after the inauguration, which was roughly 2.5 weeks before the speech to Congress, they were able to refine it, get it approved by the President in a special weekend meeting at Camp David, convert it into an address, and publish a book. So that did go on. I didn't mean to diminish what they accomplished by any means, because it, of course, is what an administration is there to do. I merely was concentrating on people because that's what I have concentrated on. There is a line of thought which I ascribe to, which is that people are policy, that not only do people write those policy papers, but they must understand it and execute it when time comes to do it. And that's why I said earlier the amount of time taken now in the selection process is to come up with those individuals who will be good executors of policy. We've had the formulators of policy in line going back to the campaign and already at work in the White House staff and in the cabinet departments. But a good political executive, a political appointee, is someone who's able to not only embrace the president's program from a philosophical framework, but also be able, through basic executive and political skills, to make sure it's carried out in the agencies and in the public at large. That's a very demanding set of talents which our American system expects of political appointees, but we have the confidence, and as this process goes along, I have increasing confidence in that system by getting people with a fresh idea, a fresh approach, but basic loyalty to the president when they go out to carry out those programs. What may be missing in them is a knowledge of how the federal government works or how the city of Washington works, and that's why my office is embarked in what will be a series of training seminars for appointees so that they will be reminded, if they haven't heard, what administration programs are, and attend a symposia on how to deal with the Congress, how to deal with the press, how to deal with career employees, what the ethical standards of the administration are, so that they will have that extra polishing and push before we put them into those bureaus to carry out that program. Judy.
some critics say that there are too many political appointees, and that leads to delays in filling all the jobs because you have so many people who are competing for them. That it also means that, from your standpoint, you begin to look on these jobs as not such hugely important jobs. You can sort of dismiss assistant secretary jobs as, what's the difference if you don't have a few assistant secretaries? But in fact, these jobs, in the view of the career people, are enormously important jobs that control the lives of most civil servants, since they rarely go see anybody who's higher than an assistant secretary. Do you agree with that policy that there are too many?
First of all, let me speak to the premise. I did not mean to denigrate or dismiss particular posts up and down the line, because those posts do matter to that department, and they do matter to the individuals who work in that department. What I meant to say is that undoubtedly there is a priority, and the priority of jobs does exist. It was one of the things to which I devoted myself during the transition planning process, and which we refined during the transition, in which, quite frankly, an Assistant Secretary of State position is more important than an Assistant Secretary in certain other departments, and therefore it's necessary for the purpose of foreign policy and national defense to begin to move on those before you might on another. It would be preferable to somehow do it all at once. But given limited resources and given the fact that government at all levels does tend to respond to stimuli, that you have to go on a priority basis. So that's how that happened to be. It is quite true, if you begin to work through the lists as we're working through them, to come across certain jobs that are presidential appointments that you wonder why they should be. And the answer is the Congress has made them so. It's unclear to me why the director of the Geologic Survey should be a presidential appointee, but that individual is. It's uncertain to me why the head of the Patents and Trademarks Office should be a presidential appointee, but it is. It's uncertain to me why the chief economists in various departments should be presidential appointees, but they are. Now, I can make just as much a case, I suppose, as to why it's necessary to have a chief economist who is sympathetic to the administration as one who might not be sympathetic to the administration. That certainly can make a stronger case for that than you can as to why the chief of the Geologic Survey should be a political appointee, or at least a non-career appointee. But we are left with what the Congress has given us. There are a number of positions you also discover as you go through that you must ask yourself why they aren't political appointees. The deputy administrator of the Small Business Administration, very key position, is something I just discovered last week was not a presidential appointment. It is something, in fact, at the hand or the choice of the administrator of the SBA. So, for whatever reason, the Congress has chosen to make some things political or presidential appointees and others not, and perhaps there is some future year there'll be a rationalizing of those into components that make more sense. But I, in saying all that, do not in any way step away from my belief that our system of government is well served by having people who are reflective of the president's choice because the president is reflective of the people's choice. As simple as that. Nothing to me in the political appointment that I held was as moving when I reflected upon it than the fact that I was serving in that job in the Navy Department by the hand of Ronald Reagan, who was serving in his job by the hand of the American people. And that I, in particular, had the additional confirmation, literally, of being voted on by the United States Senate, who were chosen by people in all the various states. Now, they did it in an afternoon with about two senators on the floor, but the principle was there that there should be that degree of confirmation with a small c before an appointee takes a place of trust. So I do like that, and it's no reflection upon career civil servants who are there by dedication, and thank goodness they are there by dedication, because we know they aren't there for means of getting rich. But in our system, which does rely upon the conferred legitimacy of government by the electoral process and by the appointment process that flows from the power of the president to make such appointments, I'm very comforted that it's worth the effort, that it is worth the effort to make those appointments and, yes, to take the time necessary to make good ones, to live up to the faith of the American people that expected us not only to have a well-functioning Department of Defense and a well-functioning Department of State, but, yes, I suppose, to have a well-functioning geologic survey, which the President of the United States has responsibility to fill. Yes, ma'am. Sorry. The question was if I consider the presidential transition to be a creative process as opposed to a political necessity. It has every making of being creative, and certainly transitions that see one party succeeding another party perforce are more creative because they must institute or find voice to particular campaign rhetoric that then has to become embodied in something more specific. That was not the case, or was less so the case in this period because of it being a friendly transition, and yet there was a degree of creativity, if you will, in what choices a president makes for his cabinet, in choosing, as he did, a physician. In this case, a minority physician to be his Secretary of Health and Human Services, President Bush was saying that he wanted someone who came from a specialized background with a different emphasis to be in charge of that very important agency than might be the case by choosing a defeated member of the Congress, let's say, or a business executive to be the cabinet chief. In choosing, as he did, his closest friend to be Secretary of State, he was saying that he wanted someone who shared not only his trust, but also his view of the world. If some might not think that to be creative, but it certainly means in practical terms that the leadership of a department, which in the past has been standoffish from the presidency, would not be. And that in the formulation of foreign policy, it would be done not just between government potentates, but between friends. And I should say, although it's the subject of a separate lecture that I will not propose to give tonight, that it's made all the difference in the world in the selection of ambassadors, which in the past administration saw very bloody clashes inside the walls of the White House in which a delegation of swordsmen or combatants, gladiators, came over from the State Department to do battle with their counterparts in the White House staff over who would get to be an ambassador. The result being an aggravation of the ancient debate over how many ambassadors should be career versus non-career. In this case, the ambassadors were selected in a very quiet process involving the non-career ambassadors, the political appointees, in a very quiet process that involved my sitting down with my former constituent from Houston, the Secretary of State, working on a list of names, which we then took to his good friend, the President of the United States, and working out an agreement on what those individuals would be. The result, a list of non-career ambassadors that is finished at this point, and no bloodshed, no bad feeling between the White House and the State Department. I consider that very creative, and I welcome it as a result, even though the notion of naming a familiar face, an inside the Beltway figure, an old friend, a Secretary of State, was not thought so of at the time. Let's see, I will lead to my chairman as to when to cut this off. I heard the sounding of the bells. As in so many things, it'll be better looking back to do the statistical glosses and the amount of time taken. It is true that if you go back to the Johnson administration, as the National Academy of Public Administration did, and put out a chart of the amount of time taken from selection to confirmation, that it's been a stair step from 7 weeks in Johnson's time to 14 weeks in Reagan's midterm. And I don't doubt that that stair step kept on by Reagan's second term and might even take another step up in the Bush administration. And that's due to several things. I wouldn't sort it out between White House selection and FBI clearance and confirmation quite yet, because many cases are different. There are many very quick and easy decisions with regard to White House selection. It was not difficult at all, for example, to come up with Ms. Constance Newman to be the director of the Office of Personnel Management. I'm happy to say that I had that idea, but I wasn't the only person who had the idea, and it was very easy to bring it right through to the president-elect and to sign off on that. But Ms. Newman has not yet been confirmed, and she will be very soon, and she will take the oath of director of what used to be called the Civil Service Commission. But the delay in between is basically the amount of time taken to do background checks and to get the nomination shaped up and sent to the Senate and for hearings to be held and for the vote to occur. And we're not in the act of blaming anybody, but in that particular case, there was less time spent on the White House end, but still the result is the same. It may take, converse terms, longer time to choose somebody to be, for example, Secretary of the Navy, Mr. H. Lawrence Garrett, but I think that nomination, which has just recently been made, is going to go through very quickly. And the background clearance also took a short amount of time, because in that instance, he was a skilled and effective government official who'd gone through clearance before and is well known on the Hill, so that I don't imagine there'll be any difficulty there. So it may seem in that instance that it took a long while, and of course the long while in his instance was due in large part to the Tower debate, but once the decision was made, things should go through rather quickly. Only looking back will we be able to sort out the numbers. Let's see. Question in the back row, gentleman there. The question was with regard to inspectors general, the difference in handling, 81-89. In 1981, the decision was made that the resignations of all inspectors general would be obtained at one time, and all inspectors general replaced roughly at one time. I believe the law was changed since then. At least the law, as presently stated, is that, yes, inspectors general may be discharged, but the president must notify the Congress of his reasons when he does it. That's a complication. It's not a deterrent of itself, but the decision was made during the transition, and it is continued on, that we would not seek the resignation of all inspectors general, that we would examine each on its merits or on the case by case. Some inspectors general are going to retire anyway in the course of 1989. Some already have, and we're proceeding in the process set up through the Office of Management and Budget to choose new ones. There's also the possibility that certain IGs can be transferred laterally. So there is one case I can think of in which an IG is not particularly liked at Cabinet Department A, but is very much wanted at Cabinet Department B. We hope that that IG will make that move. Unfortunately, he likes Cabinet Department A much better. So somehow persuading him that it's everybody would be happy, most everybody would be happy if he were to move, is going to be negotiated in the days ahead. I might add the same decision was made with regard to U.S. attorneys. Nothing could be as political as the selection of U.S. attorneys, the government's prosecutors out in the various districts. And yet the decision was made that we would not seek the resignations of all the U.S. attorneys the way we had sought and achieved the resignations of all other presidential appointees, just because of political as well as legal factors. Political factors is that every U.S. attorney has got political patrons, usually U.S. senators, who would be either upset or send back the name of that very same individual if we did it. And the other legal is that many U.S. attorneys, certainly the good ones, have got some very sensitive case either under investigation or under prosecution, and it wasn't our aim to disrupt any of those actions through that process. So we will likewise deal with U.S. attorneys on a case-by-case basis as their terms expire, as they die or retire or named to other positions. Mr. Chairman, I'll let you cut off the debate as need be. But right.
But if you can answer this without violating any confidences, what's the most outrageous act of self-promotion you can count?
The most outrageous act of self-promotion. Perhaps I've gotten a little bit inured to it completely, but I'd say that the thing that amazed me when it first began, but I later took it in stride, was opening up the pages of our hometown newspaper and reading that so-and-so was known to be under close consideration for a particular job, that individual being somebody I'd never heard of. And yet somehow or another that individual's name got in the newspaper, perhaps because of a K Street lawyer or someone hired by that individual, or just because he or she knew somebody to be able to slip that word in. This had the ironic effect, of course, of being a self-fulfilling prophecy, because when I was asked to give me the names of all those people who have expressed an interest to be the assistant secretary for whatever, yes, I'd go and clip out the article, and there would be the name of that individual. Now, that individual wouldn't, and in every instance I'm aware of, did not make it into selection, but the idea that that's somehow how things get done strikes me as odd. I'm also amazed and somewhat amused by the people who will come into my office, who therefore are finalists, and will say, well, thank you very much for this interview. Should I start a campaign for this job? Should I get letters written for you to from congressmen and senators, knowing that all that would do would be to add to my burden of letters to answer and review? And frankly, I think that those campaigns have an advantage only in bringing an individual to the attention of people like me, so that having then gotten to my attention, they then feel like they need to just beat me over the head with more bags of mail. Strikes me as somewhat outrageous, but there are more cases than that. Thank you.
Winston Churchill wrote at the end of his career, looking back on foreign policy decisions, "I have not always been wrong." After having spent the day with Chase Untermyer, we wouldn't be surprised a bit, at least in the sector of personnel, if he might say, "I have not always been wrong." One feels a sense of reassurance and confidence in the kind of personnel who will be carrying responsibilities in the years ahead that Chase Untermyer has played a principal role in this activity, and it's a great privilege for this university and for the Miller Center to have had our association with him. Thank you very much.